This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe author and explorer Craig Childs. He will be presenting the short film The Story of Place at the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, sponsored by the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, this Saturday, the 12th of September at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me here.
So I've been rereading your book, Apocalyptic Planet. We had you on the air a couple of years ago when it came out. And you, in the book, coined the term apocalyptophile. And it made me think about how many people in the United States, not to mention around the world, without really necessarily talking about it all the time, are thinking about the apocalypse, are thinking about how fragile the infrastructure is on which we entirely base our lives, and yet knowing that it wasn't always there and will not always be there. And you have that sort of front and center in your work and in your thinking.
Yeah. And I think that that some people just love the idea of apocalypse. Some people love the idea that we're gonna, you know, go hold up in a bunker and wait it out. And some people are terrified by the notion that things are as fragile as they are. That if you do look through the environmental record, climate record of the planet, you find pretty dramatic changes in the past that if we saw those now, which in a way we are seeing them now, the result could be catastrophic. So I think that I think that there's this gravity, this lure to it, this romance of apocalypse, and I've tried to write my way out of that to say no, it's actually not very romantic. You actually don't want to see this happen, but it will happen.
I'm not so aware of the romantic part of it. I mean, I guess when you were, you wrote about how when you were a teenager, you thought it was kind of cool you were going to head for the hills.
Yeah, and so many movies of just total destruction of cities and tidal waves, you know, tsunamis just coming through New York.
Which I guess is cool if you're in the theater, but...
Right, and but to be there on the ground, yeah, there's a... I understand being hesitant about our future, because it's pretty sweet right now, but it's delicate, and I think we know that. I think we know, in almost on an innate level, how much civilization protects us, but there's a much bigger world going on around us that could turn on a dime, that could really change the way we live.
What do you see as the vulnerabilities in the infrastructure that supports our lives now?
Oh, everywhere. You know, from really basic infrastructure like water mains, how old are the water mains? How old is the basic sewer water infrastructure of your community? And, you know, places on the East Coast still are operating with 100-year-old water systems. And while I was writing this book, I started putting the numbers together of, okay, so these water systems built 100 years ago were built to last 100 years. Other water systems built 20 years ago were built to last 20 years. 50 years ago, 50 years. And I just saw all these numbers leading up to right now.
Right.
And I just went, oh, wow, our water infrastructure is designed to fail all at once.
It's having a serious expiration date.
Yeah. And what that will look like, or I guess that's one of my arguments as I look at civilizations. I say, well, if that failure happened at a prosperous time, at a positive time when things were really working, then nobody would see that failure because you'd be fixing it as you go. Or is it a debt that we're accruing, and as a society, as a civilization, we become less healthy, we don't repair what we need to repair, and then boom, it starts happening all at once.
I was thinking when because I was rereading that passage about the thinness of the argument against taxation, because the only way you ever fix a water infrastructure is through taxation.
Yeah.
You're not going to have somebody who saves the money saying, gee, I think I'll start my own water infrastructure municipal fixing company.
Yeah, I think most people have no idea what kind of infrastructure is actually underneath us.
Yeah.
And how that infrastructure is funded. It didn't magically appear. There are people who are working on this, like the mine spill out of down the Animas in Colorado recently. That's an infrastructure problem. That's we don't have anything to stop that from happening, and when it happens, it's incredibly destructive. And there's a lot more waiting to come down out of the mountains. So that's one tiny thing. There are so many elements that are on the verge of breaking all the time, which maybe all of our lives look like this. I know that sometimes I look at my whole life and just go, okay, just keep moving. Nothing else fall apart. Just let's keep going into the future.
Well, I mean, there's water, there's the water infrastructure, and there's the food infrastructure.
Yeah.
And the food infrastructure is yet another thing that really could break in ways that we don't know. And famine is as universal as anything in the world.
Yeah, and we haven't felt it in a little while on a large scale, on a global scale. It wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take a significant, well, it would take a significant change, but really in the earth processes, a little glitch could really change our agriculture. For that book, I walked through a cornfield in Iowa, put on a backpack, and just took off for 3 nights at the height of summer.
And just kept walking.
And just kept walking, yeah. Set my camp up in the corn. And I was looking at GMO fields or massive agricultural fields and just saying, okay, what's going on out here? What happened to everything else that used to live here?
Exactly.
Because Iowa is 90% production. So 90% of the landscape, which is really, for us out here, it's really hard to grasp. You know, 90% of our landscape is fairly wild, or at least natural, but 90% of Iowa is covered, and I was talking to some of the farmers there, and they were telling me about how much fertilizer they had to put in. Basically, they had to put all the fertilizer in for every plant, so there's nothing left in the soil, and they said they're surviving off of this soil that's being depleted, and I said, wow, what happens when do we run out? And they all just started laughing nervously, just saying, oh, you don't want to even talk about that. And, you know, I just got this tingle in my stomach just going, so you're talking about the failure of American agriculture here. You know, what would that look like? And what if that coincided with a cold year, you know, where agriculture was low anyway? You know, I think what I came away from this book with was the realization that it's never just one thing. It's always multiple failures. It's a drought hitting during a cold period while the soil loses its fertility. You know, it's a 1-2-3 punch and you're down.
You talked about the collapse of Mayan civilization, which is really interesting and really complicated. And you said, you know, the people, historians who look at that type of thing divide the possible reasons into environmental and human caused, but they're always both.
Yeah.
And for example, there's a real relationship between warfare and drought.
Yeah. It's a historic relationship where you see drought. It's a correlation. So it's hard to tell what causes what, or even it's just a correlation that where you see drought, you usually see conflict. You see border issues, you see refugees, you see breakdown of the social network, the infrastructure. And I think conflict just rises out of that naturally. And it is, I mean, that's an interesting point, that it's either there are scientists looking at environmental causes and human causes, but when you really talk to them, they say, oh yeah, they're not different. We're just dividing our subjects to study them, but really when it comes down to it, you can't tell the difference between a human impact and a natural impact. I mean, sure, a tsunami, that's earthquake driven, but then at the same time, as I was doing research into this, I was looking at the fact that when at the end of an ice age, when glaciers are leaving, or even right now when glaciers are leaving, you have more earthquakes, you have more volcanoes. Weight is actually lifted off of the land, and the land starts shifting underneath it. So, you know, a tsunami and an earthquake could be human caused.
Exactly.
I mean, it's statistically way out there, but you could track us down. You could track CO2 to reduced ice to volcanism.
We're talking to Craig Childs. It's interesting because in the subject of collapse, there are collapses of animal populations where animals are in an area, confined area maybe, that exceeds the carrying capacity for that species, and there are, it's really ugly what happens, and really, I mean, scary from the perspective of the animal. And then there's human civilization collapses. Do they resemble each other?
Yeah. It's when you start fragmenting anything, you start fragmenting species by, you know, having border walls and highways and towns that divide the species so they're no longer able to flow genetically through each other. You see a collapse, and that collapse goes through a similar process. You see the loss of the structure. You see it being reduced to, rather than being diverse, you're reducing to single species or small numbers. And I think the same thing happens in societies where social diversity is a sign of a strong civilization, one that's moving along at a good pace. But when you see a civilization turn into one big lump, that's when you start seeing problems.
It's funny because, I mean, diversity, whether it's a human diversity within a human population or monocropping versus multicropping, diversity seems to be inherently healthier.
Yeah, and it's a curious thing that we don't... That's the major feature of this planet, its diversity. That's the major feature of its resilience. The more diverse something is, the more it's able to withstand a sudden change. I mean, when you look through the history of the Earth, like the dinosaur extinction, there was a major impact. A meteorite hit the planet and wiped out most of the dinosaurs. But you look back through Earth's history and you see other impacts that are very similar, and you don't see extinctions. And when you look at the fossil record at that time, you see that it was very diverse. So you have a diverse fossil record, boom, you have a catastrophe, life flows back in. But when the dinosaurs went extinct, their diversity was declining pretty rapidly over maybe millions of years, so that when that asteroid or meteorite hit, it was right at a crucial time, so that most animals didn't recover.
We are at a time now when we are arguably, I think it's pretty well argued that we are living through the sixth great mass extinction and that we are causes of that mass extinction. But it does bring up a kind of, I don't know, philosophical question, I guess, about human agency. Like, how much can we change and decide the effect of our actions, and how much are we collectively kind of like a giant weather pattern shift that's going to happen no matter really what we do?
Yeah, I guess the issue there is that we're a moral weather pattern. We make decisions, and I actually think that from the outside it looks like we are a major impact on species on the Earth, and we are the driver of this extinction. But when I come closer when I'm not looking at it from such a large scale, I'm seeing people who are fighting to save ecosystems, watersheds, species, and when I see what they're doing, when I'm out there on the ground seeing how much they're actually accomplishing, that's where I look at this and go, oh, this could be much, much worse. That we are actually making decisions. We are changing the way we affect the planet. And yeah, we affected in this huge negative way, changing the chemistry of the atmosphere and the oceans, changing, you know, reducing species numbers, destroying biodiversity. But that's not all we do. We have this innate desire to save things. I mean, in Iowa, when I was looking at these GMO fields, I met this woman in her 80s who was taking care of one plot, like half an acre of virgin prairie, out in the middle of nowhere, just in between all these cornfields, and she was just out there in her walker showing me the species, and I just looked at her and I thought, you'd look like anybody else in Iowa. What's up? Why do you care about this half acre? And she was going, oh, this is, why are you even asking that question? She had no answer for me because it was so intrinsic, because she said, well, this is just what you do. You protect things. And I, you know, I took that half acre plot and talked to geneticists about it, talked to conservation biologists, and a lot of people said, it doesn't really matter, that half acre, it's not going to help anything. But then I thought, this is something that we need to do. Wherever, even if it doesn't save the world, it's something that humans have to do, that we aren't just devourers. We also try to protect. I mean, that's what conservation is. That's, I think, in a lot of ways, that's what tradition is, that we try to hold on to something that we find valuable. And biodiversity is one of those things. And if there weren't people trying to hold on to it, I think we'd be living in a different world right now. Very different.
Very interesting, because I mean, I think especially among the apocalyptophiles, the kind of prevailing view is that we are on a rapid, or slightly less, or slightly more rapid slide toward destruction.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm maybe I'm Pollyannish about this, but I come back from doing a lot of research on this, spending a lot of time with scientists in the field, and putting it all together, and I my conclusion is, we don't know if we're sliding into destruction. We could be, yes, but it's not going to be as simple as we think, or maybe as soon as we think. You know, when we talk about the sixth mass extinction, yeah, it looks like we're in it right now, but these extinctions take sometimes 10,000 years to play out. So,
yeah, and as you point out, I mean, when civilizations, quote-unquote, collapse, it doesn't happen quickly. It doesn't happen all at once. Some cities are ascending within a collapsing civilization.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might be in the middle of collapse. We might be in the middle of a major collapse and not even know it.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing about the Mayans. You go down there and ask a Mayan, when did your civilization collapse? And they'll say, well, what do you mean?
We're still here.
Yeah, we're still on the ground. And you know, that's not to belittle the fact that we're losing species at an incredible pace, that we are in a catastrophic time, but it's not done yet. This extinction is going to take another 10,000 years to play out, so everything we're doing for the next 10,000 years is going to matter. So it's not just a one-way trip. I guess that's what I try to do with that book on apocalypse, was to say, apocalypse is not a blinding white flash and then it's all over. It's a process that takes, you know, it can go on for millions of years, and you might not know you're in it.
And where you weigh in on human agency is that we do have agency.
Yeah, yeah, I think we have a lot of agency. I think we're also, you know, like an ant colony. We're just doing what we do. We consume energy, we reproduce, we, you know, that's us. And to say that we have no choice, that we're just doing it naturally, I get that. Because, you know, I have two kids. Did I have a choice? I'm sure I did, but I, from this perspective of being a father, I didn't. I became a father.
Yeah.
And my biology took over.
We're talking to Craig Childs. You are dealing in your work with, I guess, kind of like scales of time and space that most people aren't really dealing with in their daily life, like geological time, cycles of ice ages, weather patterns, and a lot of these things are even bigger than the scale and time scale of the rise and fall of civilization. And you're living a limited life within time span in the late 20th, early 21st century, and that's very, very small, very limited. And I'd wondered, like, thinking that big and thinking on those big scales. How does that affect, if it does, the way you live and just go about your daily business?
That is a really good question, because I'm not sure I know. It's a piece of knowledge that affects the way I see the world, and but on the daily level, I feel like another one of the 7 billion, 8 billion human beings. You know, I get up and fix my breakfast, and I write at the computer, and I live the same way that everybody lives. And, you know, maybe I try to be conservative when possible, but I just drove down here. I just used a tank of gas to get here from Colorado. I am part of this civilization. But I also have a sense of where we are. So maybe on the daily level, it's hard to tell how it works on the daily level, but on a bigger scale, across the length of my life, I feel like I'm looking at our species and going, oh, this is the direction we want to go. So I'm going to be pushing, or the direction I want to go, seeing how we affect things over the next 1,000 years, over the next 1,000,000 years, you know, on out. I like to think about how we affect the future of the planet and then say we can make changes. Because we're, if you came back to this Earth in 10 million years, you would find things in a state that we invented.
Not 10 million years.
Yeah, because that's, you know, an extinction, a mass extinction can take that long to play out until you come back to a high level of biodiversity again. And so the animals, the plants that we are able to get through this extinction right now are going to be the ones that are here in 10 million years. The ones that we're watching drop off the map every day, they're gone. They're not going to be part of that future. So in many ways, we are defining what the Earth landscape, animal, plant landscape will look like in 10 million years.
Craig Childs is just about to go, but do you want to tell us a little bit about the short film that you'll be presenting at the event this weekend? It's called The Story of Place.
Yeah, I went out with a filmmaker into Southeast Utah, and we actually went out for a couple of years just wandering around for days at a time with a camera, telling stories and looking at these canyon landscapes, and then it developed into this film, which is a defense for a piece of land that's at risk, a large chunk of the desert in Southeast Utah, and I wanted to do a film about the history of the place, to say, you know, you see these canyons and these vistas, but do you see what's underneath them? Do you see, here are the potsherds, here are all these other stories that are so much older than ours, and wouldn't it be something if we held on to something like this, if we didn't just lose another piece of history, another piece of landscape in the world?
Especially for a little bit of fossil fuel that's going to contribute to the problem in the first place.
Yeah, there's not a heck of a lot there, and it would take this would be a tar sands development, so it would be a huge earth-eating scenario if this actually happened.
It's a very beautiful short film. I was just watching it, and whoever your cinematographer was, they're awesome.
Yeah, Sinway Xavier is his name. Interesting character, good person to be out in the desert with.
Craig Childs is an author, explorer, storyteller, and he will be presenting this film. We were talking about The Story of Place at the Wild and Scenic Film Festival, sponsored by the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. It's this Saturday, the 12th of September, at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion. The film festival starts at 6 o'clock, and there's also a special members party at 4:30. So if you want to come on down a little early, you can join the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, become a member, and hear a special presentation by Craig Childs. For ticket information, you can go to the Law Center's website. New Mexico Environmental Law Center is nmelc.org. Craig Childs, thank you so much for being with us.
Certainly, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.